Good morning. You're listening to KUNV 91.5, and this is Neon Eden. I'm your host, Patrick Kulikin. You can read my columns in the Las Vegas Sun and on LasVegasSun.com. My co-host, as always, Sun reporter Tovin Lepan. The legislature is in the middle of its 120-day, every-other-year sprint, and there's been a lot happening the past week, from gay marriage to mining taxes, from the expulsion of an assemblyman to the resignation of the state school superintendent. Joining us to talk about all this is Sun political editor Anjanette Damon, who joins us from Carson City. Hi, Anjanette. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So you're kind of drinking out of a fire hose lately, aren't you?
It's been a little bit crazy, yeah, but it's fun.
All right, let's just go down the list here of what's happened, I think just in the past week. We're taping on Monday. Gay marriage. We have a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage that Democrats and maybe even some Republicans want overturned. Tell us what happened last week.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because they timed it right with the federal activity on gay marriage as well. Of course, the U.S. Supreme Court's hearing that. In Carson City, there was a very lengthy, at times emotional, hearing on a measure that would allow voters to go back and repeal the constitutional amendment that they put in there in 2004, I believe, defining marriages between a man and a woman. Now, since voters did that, the legislature has taken some steps. In 2009, they passed a domestic partnerships bill. But they've always been walking kind of this fine line over, you know, some people that really believe that there should be marriage equality, true marriage equality in this state are somewhat worried about going back to the voters on exactly this issue. They don't want to press their luck. They don't want another referendum that may cement the definition of marriage as between a man and a woman in this state. So they've kind of inched up to this little by little, and now we're to the point where you have some important politicians either refining their position on marriage equality rights in the state of Nevada or altogether reversing themselves. We've gotten to the point where, all right, let's get it back before voters, but you don't hear anyone yet saying, let's propose a marriage equality law in the state of Nevada legislature. So again, they're still walking this line, and they're edging closer and closer to what advocates of true marriage equality rights might advocate for.
And so the first step here would just be a measure to get through both houses of the legislature, and then it would go before the voters twice.
That's right. No, it would go before. It goes to the legislature twice.
So legislature twice, okay.
Right. If the legislature passes it this session, they'd pass it again in 2 years, and then it would go before the voters for ratification in 2016.
Right, because the next session is 2015, and then before the voters in 2016. And 2016, a presidential year, and presumably certain kinds of voters will be, not to be morbid, but certain kinds of voters will be dying, and other kinds of voters will come into voting age.
That's one way to look at it. I mean, polling does show that the younger generation just couldn't care less about. I mean, that's one way of putting it. It's not necessarily that they're vocal advocates seeing themselves as on the civil rights battle for marriage equality rights, but you know, they're just kind of like live and let live. We don't need the government telling people what kinds of people they can marry. So you do see the bigger shift in opinion among the younger voters. But you know, on the other hand, and I think this is changing in Nevada and probably wouldn't be nearly as successful. But early in, you know, obviously in 2004, there were marriage equality rights, definition of marriages between a man and a woman, ballot questions on the ballots in states all over the country as a way to turn out the vote for George W. Bush and Republicans. So it has been used as kind of a wedge issue to get conservative voters out. And I don't know necessarily that would be as successful a strategy in Nevada anymore.
Right. And in fact, it almost seems to have flipped where these social issues have kind of gone the other way.
And the landscape could change a lot. It's concerning the Supreme Court's looking at the issue
right now,
yeah. Between now and 2016.
Depending on what this court says, that could also change things.
That's right.
And Jenna, also another hot topic is SJR 15, a proposed constitutional amendment. Could you tell us what would that do and why it's so important?
Right, yeah. So SJR 15 was proposed for the first time last session when the mining industry really became the target of some high-profile Democrats and other constituencies who believe that the mining industry, which is maybe the only one in the state right now making fistfuls of money in the economic recession, that they should be paying
other
more in taxes.
Other than the media.
Yeah, we sure are going gangbusters, aren't we? Anyway, so this was proposed last session. And what it would do, as it stands now, lawmakers are not free to change the tax rate on mining because it is enshrined in the Constitution. In 1989, voters agreed with a ballot question that allowed the mining tax rate to increase to 5%. This is the net proceeds on minerals that they raised it to 5%, but there's also a clause in there that says no other tax shall be levied on the minerals until the identity of such is lost. So when it becomes
what does that mean until the identity as such is lost?
Yeah, that's an interesting, and it would be debated ad nauseum in court, I'm sure. But basically, the mining industry wants their tax to be considered a property tax so that it falls under that property tax rate. It falls under the Uniform and Equal Clause. And so when you think of the gold in the dirt, it needs to be mined, obviously, and there's lots of different processes for doing that. So once it's been mined, and I'm not exactly sure where that cutoff is, if it's when it becomes a gold bullion or a gold bar or a gold bracelet. But once it's no longer a mineral that's in the earth, it's part of, say, the property, then it's considered the gold product, and maybe you could levy some taxes on that. And I think you see the legislative lawyers arguing that you could levy some taxes on that. But as it stands, they want that to be included in the property tax. So back to SJR 15, this would allow voters to take that provision out of the Constitution entirely. So you take the 5% cap on the net proceeds on minerals out of the Constitution. You also take out that clause that says no other tax should be levied on the mineral itself. That way, the legislature would be free to impose a different kind of tax. Now, the mining industry will come in and say, well, if you take that out of the Constitution, then we fall under the normal property tax rate, which is lower. It's capped at $3.65 per $100 of assessed valuation. That's what we would pay, whatever that county rate is. It's even lower in some counties, particularly the rural counties that have mining. That rate's lower than $3.65. So they'll say, we'll just start paying that. The legislative lawyers say, well, no, the legislature's free to do what it wants, and there's other provisions in the Constitution that would in statute that would require you to pay 5%. But basically, this would it sounds very confusing, and it was the subject of a very heated hearing this week, but it would allow voters to take that constitutional provision that protects mining out of the Constitution.
So, yeah, just to boil it down, The supporters of this amendment say this would allow us to raise taxes on the mining industry. And you were getting deep into the weeds there, but it is an important debate that came up at the hearing. And essentially what the industry is saying is, well, we would actually revert to the same property taxes that everybody else pays because you can't enact a special tax just on gold. Do I have that right?
Right, yeah, that the land that they own or the land that they are operating on would fall under the same property tax scheme that anybody else's land would fall under. And, you know, I think you're right, I did get into the weeds, and I think that's part of the mining industry's strategy is to delve as far into the weeds as they possibly can on this, and they bring all sorts of arcane constitutional arguments and legal arguments, and you know this is going to end up in court forever, and they really distract, I think, from the overall issue of should the mining industry be paying more on the product that they're taking from, you know, Nevada lands, and so you saw this kind of erupt in this hearing last week, and one of the, I guess, most shining moments, if you want to call it that, was when Senate Minority Leader Michael Roberson got the microphone. And he has been a vocal opponent of the mining industry. I guess he says he supports mining, but he's also been a critic of the mining industry. And he now, ironically, for a Republican, is spearheading the effort to both take the mining constitutional tax provision out of the Constitution and raise taxes on mining. And he had a line to the industry lobbyist on Tuesday. He said, you know, I respect your intelligence. I just don't think that you respect ours. And you are misleading this committee with all sorts of what he called false legal arguments.
That was to James Wadhams, right?
Right. That was to James Wadhams, who is, you know, he's well respected here. He represents mining. He has for a long time. He represents other major industries in the state as well. But yeah, that is part of, he's well known for this. Mr. Wadhams is you know, just diving really deep into the weeds, which, you know, for reporters is good. We need to understand the issue, and, you know, lawmakers need to understand the issue, and sometimes the public just hears the top line of it. So, you know, I respect that about him. But sometimes sometimes the weeds distract from what the overall issue is.
Right. Obfuscation as a strategy, almost.
Almost.
We won't go that far. So what is the status, do you think, of SDR 15? Interesting. I think this, and this was noted by some folks, that Democrats were fairly mum during that hearing.
Yeah. You know, last session, this was a Democratic, or caused by Democrats.
It's right.
A Democratic Sheila constituency Leslie and has been calling for it. Sheila Leslie from Reno, who was defeated, ironically, again, by a Republican. The mining industry spent heavily in that race to defeat her. They helped support Senator Greg Brower, who was victorious in that race and who has signed on to Michael Roberson's efforts, and who also took a very aggressive stance in that committee hearing against the mining industry. Greg Brower is supporting now the removal. He's supporting SGR 15
right.
and taxing mining more.
No honor amongst thieves.
No.
So back to my question, though, Dems were kind of quiet, and what's going to happen here, do you think?
Yeah, you know, the champions for this were Stephen Horsford and Sheila Leslie last session. During the interim and between sessions, the mining industry has spent a lot on lobbying and trying to take SJR 15 off the radar screen. And since you lost, you know, I think this is kind of a real personal issue and cause for Sheila Leslie and Stephen Horsford. They're out of the legislature, and, you know, nobody really on the Democratic side has taken that up as their torch to bear. That's not to say that they disagree with the direction or that they oppose SJR 15, but they haven't been the vocal champions. And in that committee, you know, Senator Kuhn asked a question, you know, does the mining industry pay enough in taxes? Of course, the mining industry said, of course we do. We pay all the taxes that any other business pays, plus this 5% net proceeds tax. Senator Dennis asked a question or two, but they were pretty quiet. At the end of the hearing, after the committee voted unanimously to approve SJR 15 and send it to the full Senate for a vote, the Democrats were the first out with a press release saying, yay, we did it. But in the committee and also in press conferences and just general rhetoric, the Democrats have been rather silent. They left a vacuum, and Senator Roberson jumped right in to fill it.
Interesting.
And Jeanette, moving on, you know, if the legislation wasn't enough to cover, obviously there's been the strange and ongoing saga of Stephen Brooks. Mm. And I think the Sun even printed a headline on Thursday, like, Brooks saga ends with removal from assembly. And I was like, we have to know that can't be the end of the saga.
The Brooks saga will continue, but it did close the chapter in the legislature, at least.
And what was the general sentiment up there during the vote, the voice vote, I guess, when you didn't really have to identify yourself, but what was the sentiment among the fellow assemblymen?
You know, it was difficult to watch, let alone participate in. It was extremely emotional, and I know some of the comments from readers on the stories that we've been writing from Carson City have kind of, you know, ridiculed that emotion a little bit, just like, come on, guys. Got up, do your job. This man's been a distraction, and he deserves to go.
And our commenters are known as some of the best of humanity.
Some of the best, for sure. But, you know, this, and we become jaded and cynical, and the reporters on covering this story have really focused on the process and maybe have been critical of some of the process. But when you come down, there's such a human factor here. Assemblyman Brooks obviously is a human being, and he has caused a lot of grief, a lot of strife, a lot of anger among a lot of people. But he's still someone that they've known well. This is an unprecedented step that they've taken to oust an assemblyman, one of their own. Usually you see particular, you know, Democrats and Republicans, but kind of circle the wagons and protect their own, and this became a case that it was just impossible to do, and the emotion was really raw. Speaker Marilyn Kirkpatrick, who has been living with police presence since the start of the session, since January 19th, when Assemblyman Brooks was first arrested on charges of threatening her life, she's been walking around with a police detail, you know, at home, at the legislature, pretty much everywhere she goes. And to read those words, Assemblyman Brooks has been expelled and his seat is vacant. She was very emotional. She openly cried. She had to take a couple halting breaths to compose herself. She wasn't the only one who was emotional. There were members on the floor wiping away tears and sitting rather stoically. So it was a pretty intense moment when it came time for that vote.
You mentioned the process. Our former colleague John Ralston was quite critical of the secrecy of some of the proceedings. Tell us about that, but I also know there's kind of a collective effort to get the committee report, right?
That's right. So the legislature appointed this select committee to investigate whether Brooks was fit to continue serving. They named a special counsel. That special counsel, Mark Ferrario of Las Vegas, conducted an investigation. He hired an investigator, and they conducted a pretty standard investigation that resulted in two 25-page investigative reports and 900 pages of material to back up the conclusion in those reports. He declared all of that information must remain confidential, and because all of that information was confidential, they closed the hearing in which they presented the report and in which the committee members made the decision to recommend that Brooks be expelled. Now, I don't think that anyone would disagree that there is information in those reports that, by law and by decency, remain private. There's medical records, we understand, that are in that report. There are employment records that may be in that report.
His psychiatric history, essentially.
That's what one would assume.
Right.
Again, they're being very, very quiet about the particulars. But there's also information that maybe would affect an ongoing criminal investigation. So, you know, there's protected information in that report. That said, there's a coalition of 14 news organizations that have signed on to a letter saying the report needs to be public record if there's information in that by law under HIPAA or some other protection law it can be redacted. But the proceedings have been rather confidential, and that makes it difficult to determine what the standard is by which Brooks was expelled. There's a lot of public information. Obviously, his arrests and his behavior have been well reported. The incident Thursday night after he was expelled, leading California, San Bernardino County sheriffs and California Highway Patrol on the high-speed chase, there's been very public displays of the behavior that they have judged incompatible with the legislature. But when it comes down to it, what that actual fireable offense is remains shrouded.
Is it possible that there's other things in that report, that there were other misdeeds and malfeasance tucked in there? There was certainly a lot of whisperings around the legislature that there were red flags about Brooks.
There's been chatter around the legislature that he perhaps used his office unethically, that he used his position to intimidate state employees, perhaps, or that he made improper requests of lobbyists. It's my understanding that there's not a lot of that information, if any, in the report. Lobbyists I've spoke to say they weren't interviewed. Obviously, I didn't talk to every lobbyist in the building. But it seems to have really focused on this other erratic behavior. Now, that's not to say that there isn't necessarily information in that report that could be embarrassing to other lawmakers. Many lawmakers were interviewed, I understand, by the special counsel and the investigator. So there's information, and that's what we don't know. And I don't want to draw conclusions about what we don't know, but I think that's why it's important to release the report. So it's not, the shroud of secrecy is not being used to protect information that may be embarrassing to people, but rather very specific information that, you know, through some other law is already considered to be private and not released to the public.
Okay, we know you have to go, but real quickly, Friday afternoon, the Friday afternoon before Easter, known to Christians as Good Friday, the state superintendent of public instruction resigned. Very strange. What happened?
Yeah, you know, if you don't want any information to nobody to take notice of your announcement, do it on Good Friday, Friday afternoon, a Friday before Easter, even better, a Friday where you have the entire press corps chasing after the story of
Stephen Brooks, right?
A disintegrating settlement, yeah. But Superintendent Guthrie had a very short tenure. He was appointed as the first state superintendent under the new state law that's supposed to streamline education governance in the state. He was the first one that Sandoval appointed. However, since taking that job, he's become a bit of a lightning rod. He's it was criticized for not being exactly eloquent in describing the governor's education agenda before legislative committees. He made some comments about class size reduction not really being paramount or even all that important.
He said Nevada's a poor state.
Which I don't think we appreciated much. He angered Las Vegas when he went up to Reno and told the Reno Gazette Journal's editorial board that Washoe County looks like a dream compared to Clark County schools. He was a bit rough around the edges, which I think reporters probably appreciated, but you know, Governor Sandoval's administration is known for being very cautious, very disciplined. You don't have really any of these firebrands running around, you know, saying things off the cuff that would reflect poorly or not exactly explain the governor's agenda very well. So, you know, I don't know that many people were surprised at this resignation.
So we think he was asked to leave.
I would, you know, I can't go on record saying that the governor asked him to resign, but that is my impression.
All right. Well, thanks, Anjanette. We know you have to run. You're very busy. We really appreciate your time, and we will catch up with you later in the session.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks for having me.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Now we're joined by Paul Takahashi. He's the Sun's education reporter. And we are going to talk about the Nevada Superintendent of Public Instruction, James Guthrie, resigned late in the day on Friday, the Friday before Easter. What did you make of that, Paul?
Sure. Well, it's clearly a taking out the trash is what they call it in journalism. You know, late on a Good Friday, the Sandoval administration announced that they initially announced in their press release that they have selected an interim superintendent. So that wasn't even, you know, the story there. You know, the resignation didn't make it until sort of the second or third sentence in that news.
It was almost like they got the order of the emails wrong.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But, hey, we have an interim superintendent. Whoa, what happened to the other superintendent?
Right.
Yeah. They were hoping we'd skip that part.
Yeah,
I'm sure they were. Yeah. Well, you know, Guthrie was sort of a lightning rod for the administration. Uh-huh. And
not here long, right?
Not here long, less than a year.
And it was the first time that we had this position.
Right, previously it was appointed by the school board, state school board, and this was the first time that the state superintendent was appointed by the governor. And so the governor had a lot of power. And about a year ago, it would have been a year tomorrow, actually, Tuesday of this week. And so about less than a year ago, you know, Sandoval announced that Guthrie is going to be the state superintendent, had this huge, you know, press release and introducing him. He was really gushing, you know, at that time about, you know, what a great, you know, superintendent he was going to be for the state. He came from the George W. Bush Policy Institute, you know, as an education scholar. And so he brought a lot of ideas, but of course he was a bit of a lightning rod here. Lots of controversy surrounding his positions on a lot of different school reform issues, most notably the class size reduction policies.
Uh-huh. I mean, in general, he was, even when he came in, if you looked at his resume, you kind of knew that he was a right side of the spectrum education reformer. Give us some background on who he was and what he represented.
Sure. Well, you know, I think, you know, he was definitely someone who said that, you know, the quality of the teacher really mattered. And so his focus was really on teachers. So he really pushed hard for a new teacher evaluation system, which was already in the works, but he really, you know, sort of tried to make that one of the focal issues of his administration.
They finished that?
Yeah, well, it's still in the works. So The Teachers and Leaders Council came out with a set of recommendations over the summer. And, you know, they're still now in the works of trying to tweak it this legislative session. And so that's going to be an implementation implementation this upcoming school year, but they may need some more time to get it fully worked out. But sort of in line with that, you know, the class size reduction, you know, his comments to the legislature this time around a few weeks ago, actually, he told lawmakers that, hey, you know, a quality teacher can handle a class size of 50 or, you know, or so, you know, students. And so that sort of came, you know, just garnered a lot of criticism from teachers unions who said, well, hey, you know, we've got class sizes that are some of the largest in the nation. You know, this is a problem for teachers. And no matter how well a teacher teaches, they can't handle necessarily a class size of that.
And he was basically saying that's not that big of a deal.
Basically.
And ultimately, Sandoval, I mean, these were sort of embarrassing moments at the legislature. I think also, I mean, there were some other ones. He called Nevada a poor state.
He did. He also said that Washoe County public schools were a dream when compared to Clark County, and apparently that riled former superintendent Dwight Jones here up, and so he had to, you know, apologize to him, apparently. And so there were a lot of, you know, sort of gaffes and a lot of missteps along the way. And a lot of observers are saying, well, he sort of became a political liability for Sandoval, who's really trying to be the education governor, trying to push through some reforms here. And, of course, you know, he has some education increases that he's hoping for the legislature this time around.
And, so, and in fact, he just announced one today.
He did, yeah, today, just the weekend after he announced Guthrie's resignation. He has announced that because of initial state money that was found, he is going to push for a $25 million increase in education funding.
So. And some of that will be ELL and all-day kindergarten.
I'm assuming so, yeah, yeah. Those are his two top priorities for education funding.
And it's Guthrie may, in fact, we don't even know where he stood on all-day kindergarten. He's probably skeptical of that,
He was a little skeptical of that, I would imagine. There were a lot of critics of Head Start programs. You know, it's been around for a long time, and, you know, critics say, hey, you know, you haven't seen a lot of increases in, you know, test scores and things like that as a result. So there may be some short-term gains at the beginning, they say, but maybe not long-term. But,
right.
Of course, there are a lot of people who say, you know, these kids are coming from far behind, you know, coming from disadvantaged backgrounds. They may need that support.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that the gains disappear at third grade or whatever, so to me, it's always been an argument for improving things at third grade and after.
Sure.
Not for whatever. Yeah. All right, so what will come next? Who will he select, do you think?
Well, there's a process in place, it seems. I'm not quite sure if they're going to be deviating from that. The press release on Friday didn't really specify how they're going to choose the next superintendent. But it's usually a process where, you know, the state school board may nominate a few candidates, and then, you know, the governor will choose appoint one. And so would assume that that's the same process that's going to be taking place.
With Dwight Jones leaving, the Clark County superintendent, and then now Guthrie leaving, I feel like there's been a lot of backlash about the outside candidates, people from outside Nevada. Do you think that this will cause them to turn internally to someone from Nevada?
We don't need no outsiders.
Well, who knows? You know, there's been a lot of calls, especially locally, you know, for some, you know, Pascal Korkowski, the interim superintendent, to stay on as the Clark County superintendent. So we don't know if that's going to happen at the statewide level. I'm already hearing some folks who say, you know, we should have somebody local. So
local meaning?
You know, Nevada Reed? Statewide.
Carson or
Nevadan? Nevadan, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Nevada's education system has proved excellent. So, so why wouldn't we choose someone local? All right. Thanks, Paul. We appreciate you coming on. Our producer, Steven Zeller, we want to thank him. My co-host, Hovind LePan. I'm Patrick Kulik, and you've been listening to Neon Eden on KUNV 91.5. Catch us next week.